find the longest path.
Whoa. Hello, welcome to Complexity Cast number 8. Today, once again, we have this podcast in memory of poor Bogusarch.
What? I'm not dead yet.
Well, just in case you're dead, by the time this podcast airs, you know, I want to just remember you the way you are. This could be the last being recorded message you have ever said.
I hope not, because this is my fourth of your 8 podcasts. I've been in 4 of them after today. I want to break the half barrier. I want to be bounded away from half.
This is a podcast we recorded back in September, the day after I recorded the previous podcast. Okay, Bill, so today, what are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about, does P equal NP or not? But we have someone else to sort of be here in spirit.
So we're going to channel Scott Aronson, who...
he's not dead either, actually.
I can just hear Scott saying, I'm not dead yet! Scott Aronson did a weblog entry back in, I don't know when, which I will leave a pointer to on the weblog. 10 reasons why he thinks P not equal NP. Now, I'm not disagreeing with the conclusion. I strongly believe P not equal NP, Bill.
Right, I'd agree.
Yes. As we know, as you also know, and also give a link, Bill had as a survey.
Yes, that's right. 99% of all complexity theorists think that P is NP, and those that disagreed did some kind of protest vote.
Nevertheless, Scott did give 10 reasons why he thinks P not equal NP, and Bill and I have decided to review his reasons.
Review them, perhaps agree with him, perhaps disagree with him, perhaps agree with each other, perhaps right. Not.
Yes. Now, keep in mind again, P does not equal NP. Let me tell a quick story. So there was another complexity theorist I was talking to. Somehow we got into question of the P versus NP problem. You know, it comes up every now and then.
Constantly.
And he said, you know, I have to be politically correct and say P not equal NP. And I looked at him and I said, P not equal NP, it's not just PC, it's C. Because, trust me, P doesn't equal NP. And then, you know, after we go through Scott's reasons, Bill and I, we should give our own reasons why we think P doesn't equal NP.
Fair enough. Okay, so...
Reason number
one.
Odds or evens, Bill?
Oh, I'll take evens.
All right. Okay, so I'll read Scott's argument and then we will dissect it. So, reason number one, the oblivious argument. After half a century, we still don't know any algorithm for an NP-complete problem that runs in sub-exponential time. Bill?
Well, he's right, we don't. But is that actually a good reason? We don't know it yet.
Well, in fact, Howard Karloff once tried to give me an argument in the exact opposite direction. We know no superlinear lower bounds for, say, satisfiability.
Therefore, SAT obviously has a linear circuit for it.
Yeah, the problem is we know nothing about the complexity of satisfiability as far as running time goes.
Yeah, and also what I wonder is, before 1983, whatever it was, you might say linear programming. We know no polytime algorithm for it. Therefore, it's not NP.
So, in fact, the obvious argument is both obviously proves P equals NP and proves P not equal NP at the same time.
Okay, well, which way do you go for?
All right. Number two,
number one. It's a classic problem. We tell our undergraduates, just because you can't solve the Hawking problem doesn't mean it can't be solved, and then, of course, so it's undecidable.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay. Two. Reason two. The empirical argument. While the argument based on the decades of math work can stand on its own, in the case of P versus NP, we also have half a century of evidence from the computer industry. In a few cases, like linear programming and formality, people wanted fast ways to solve the problems in practice, and they came up with them long before it was proven tractable.
So, what about this argument?
Okay, well, he's saying that even things that were not in P originally, like linear programming, before linear programming was in P, there were hints of it because it was already in good empirical time. Satisfiability is right. Satisfiability, we do not have good... fair question. Do we have good things for SAT in practice?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no.
But enough to actually say, gee, maybe it's NP.
I don't think so. We don't, you know, there are plenty of NP problems where we don't have good algorithms in practice.
But how do you compare the status of satisfiability now with that of linear programming in 1980, say?
Well, even in 1980, I mean, we had algorithms that seemed to solve all the linear programs we cared about.
Ah, okay. And we had to have contrived examples. Why wouldn't always work?
That's right. But in fact, now, of course, we have polynomial time linear programming, polynomial time primality. I mean, yes, people have worked on these problems, but of course, you can go to mathematics and see plenty of things people have done for years as well, much longer than people have thought about P versus NP even informally.
Okay, so you would say that just because we haven't had anything with SAT recently, or even though SAT's not softened up yet, who knows?
Yeah, but that's still, I think this is a reasonable argument for p-not-equal NP.
Okay.
Number three, the Bayesian arguments. Well, I can't return the last two arguments on the head. So say that if our failure to find a fast algorithm is evidence of p-not-equal NP, then our failure to prove p-not-equal NP is likewise evidence that P equals NP.
Fair point.
Why not confused? The answer is because lower bounds are harder to prove than upper bounds.
Currently.
Oh, so this is kind of attacking our attack on the first argument.
And think, he's not even here. Wow, Scott is a formidable opponent. Okay, so he says lower bounds are harder. Is he right?
Certainly in practice, it's been much harder to prove lower bounds than upper bounds. But again, for SAT, we haven't been able to prove bounds in either direction. So it's really not much of an argument either way.
Okay, lower bounds are hard now. But just like, you know, just because you can't prove a lower bound on SAT now doesn't mean it can't be done. Doesn't mean it can't be done. I'm not a fan of this argument, actually, because, we don't know enough. Also, I should point out, Lance, you're an old guy. When was SAT proven NP complete?
SAT was proven NP complete by Cook in 1971.
Okay, and how many years ago was that?
Carries a two. 35 years?
Right, and it's 35 years a long time mathematically. Oh my gosh, we haven't made any progress in 35 years. It must be so-and-so.
Yeah, well, let me ask you another question, though. Yeah. Suppose you had to bet on whether we would find a proof of p-not-equal NP or P equals NP in the next 50 years.
Wow, that's an excellent question, because if I was told to solve one of them in 50 years, I'd just say it's a hard call. Because if P is not NP, it's a long haul, I think. If P equals NP, it could be some clever trick that someone just overlooked. I kind of doubt that, but I mean, eek. So a 50-year time span, I call it a wash. What do you call it? Your promise will be solved in 50 years. Bet which way it's going to go.
Well, I would definitely bet P equals NP.
Okay.
Because, you know, by actually this argument that Scott's making. Because if we're actually going to prove it, it's much easier to find an algorithm for SAT than to find the lower bounds. Although,
we're not going to find either.
I mean, the conditional on that we find a proof at all.
Okay.
Number four.
I do evens?
You do evens. Okay. Yes.
The multiple surprise argument. Here's a point that's not often stressed. For P to equal NP, not just one, but many astonishing things would be true. First, factorings in P. Second, factoring would have to be as hard as breaking one-way functions. Third, breaking one-way functions would have to be as hard as solving NP problems on average. Fourth, solving NP problems on average would have to be as hard as solving them in the worst case. Fifth, NP would have to have quasi circuits. Sixth, NP would have to equal co-NP, and so on. None of these seems plausible.
Well, I mean, these are... I think you're all begging the question here.
Yeah.
I mean, none of these seem plausible, but they all seem more plausible than p-not-equal NP.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's... I can see SAT having poli-sci circuits before I can see P equals NP. I mean, there may be some weird Kolmogorov random string, blah, whatever, that helps you solve self-liability. I don't know. So, yeah, I find this to be not credible as an argument goes.
It's true that P equals NP would give a lot of surprises.
Okay.
P-not-equal NP would also have a huge number of implications, though.
But it would be surprising.
But none would be surprises, because, of course, since we believe that, we believe all the implications.
Yeah, so I call that argument, what's that phrase people math use? Polygonal, circular. That's what it is. It's a circular argument. Okay, actually, so a question for you, Lance. So count so far. Argument one, we found credible or not?
Argument one, I thought, is an obvious argument that works both ways.
Okay, so not credible. Empirical argument.
Felt is actually kind of thing we know to reach, but no success finding. Yeah. That's a reasonable argument.
Bayesian, no.
Bayesian, this relates back to number one. The multiple surprises.
No.
Mildly.
No, I give that thumbs down.
Thumbs down and up are trademarked by Roger Newman Incorporated.
Oh, okay. I give it a pinky up. No.
A pinky.
Five is odd, I believe. That's your turn.
Okay, the hierarchy argument. This argument goes back to the early days of P versus NP. Scott, you weren't born yet. We know that P is strictly contained in X by the time hierarchy theorem. It follows that either P is strictly contained in NP, or NP is strictly contained in P space, or P space is strictly contained in X. Likewise, NL is strictly contained in P space by the space hierarchy theorem. So either NL is strictly contained in P, or P is strictly contained in NP, etc. But if some of these separation hold, why not all of them?
What?
So, I mean, this, I mean, it, right, I mean, so either, for example, either, they'll just take P and P space, for example. I mean, either P doesn't equal L, or P doesn't equal P space.
Or both. But you're saying it's possible both. That there's one of those.
So, I mean, either one of them or both of them have to hold. So, I mean, so we know there has to be some separation. So, why not P and P? I mean, this. I mean, the nice thing, you're right, you can't have everything collapsing. So life is not that perfect. Okay, but it could be the case that everything separates.
And it could be the case that P is not equal to L.
P is not equal to NP, IP doesn't equal P space, oops.
Oops, yeah.
Sometimes collapses do occur that catch you off guard.
Yes, I mean, it's all kinds of...
But nevertheless, I think this is actually, it's actually a reasonable
I don't
point
think so.
Here.
Oh, okay, so I mean...
Bill, you are so negative.
Lance, no. Lance, yes. Bill, no on this one.
Yes.
Okay, six. The known algorithms argument. We do have non-trivial efficient algorithms for problems in NP, such as matching, self-marriage, minifactory, I think it was in P, matrix inversion, planar testing, etc. But every one of the algorithms depends in a crucial way on some combinatorial or algebraic structure of the problem. It's a fancy way of saying the obvious. We don't know how to solve NP problems yet. I don't think it is. It's possible to imagine a situation where we have a few generic techniques for achieving speedups on some things, but puzzles imagine a situation where we know generic techniques for achieving actual speedup which work for objects as complicated as Turing machines, and the only problem was that we didn't know yet how to apply it to prove P equals NP. But this is nothing like the actual situation. I don't understand this one. Rephrase it, please.
I'll rephrase it. Yeah. Roughly what he's saying is that for some specialized problems, we do have algorithms.
Yeah.
You know, shortest path and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more specific. But they take into advantage some specific structure that we don't seem to have in the general NP problems.
Well, let me say, I have thought of in different terms. When I see that satisfiability is NP complete, and say Hamiltonian cycle is NP complete, SAT could be called problem in logic. Hamiltonian cycle a problem in graph theory. What I'm thinking is that there's such different domains, it's not really about logic, it's not really about graph theory, it's really about nothing. It means there's no structure to grasp onto. There's no actual thing you can say there. So I'm thinking it's unlikely you can use techniques from graph theory to solve it, because that would mean that graph theory applies to problems in logic and other things as well, and it just doesn't seem right. That is, I don't think deep graph theory is the answer.
So I don't think algebraic techniques, for example, might help you make satisfiability easier than some generic search problem.
Yeah, that's correct.
So you don't believe that IP is P-space?
Well, that's the point. I've always, yeah.
I mean, so the point is, we actually do have an example
Okay. Where
you're able to apply techniques to specifically satisfiability free set that you can apply to a sort of generic search problems.
Okay, so you're saying that maybe deep algebra was used for satisfiability.
Hardly deep.
Well, I don't know.
Every degree of deep polynomial has the most deep roots.
Well, it's one parable theorem, I'll tell you. Okay, so you're saying there are cases where we have actually used techniques from field A and field B.
So number one, that. We've actually managed to use the structure of SAT that's not true for generic search problems.
All right, that's the point.
And another case, another example is zero-knowledge proofs, computational zero-knowledge proofs for SAT.
Or for
NP complete problems.
Okay.
Don't work in the generic search problems, but do work for specific NP complete problems.
So therefore, you find argument 6-6 not compelling.
Having said that, we don't have any luck actually using any of these problems, you know, outside of these interactive proof or cryptographic domains. So,
well, however, you've convinced me. Bill saying no to 6.
And Lance is saying he's not sure.
Oh, please, Lance, you got to take a stand.
I'm going to say yes to 6.
Oh, wow, I'm amazed. We began with me saying yes, you saying no.
That's all.
All right.
How things change.
Indeed.
Okay, 7 is mine, right?
Yep.
the known lower bounds argument. It could be that the dream of proving super polynomial lower bounds on circuit size is no more than that, a pipe dream. But the fact remains we can prove super polynomial lower bounds, albeit in weaker models of computation are easier to analyze. Resolution proofs, monotone circuits, etc., etc., etc.
Oh, I find this very weak. I mean, we have such weak lower bounds on such contrived models.
It's good. I wouldn't say contrived, but I would say extremely weak.
Okay, I know, it's good research, of course, and it should be funded, of course. In fact, everything should be funded. No, seriously.
Yeah,
no.
You're getting off topic here.
Okay, yeah, I got it. The point is that monotone circuits, I do find monotone circuit lower bounds interesting, but I don't find that relevant to ZenP. I find branching programs in my current field complexity interesting, but to actually scale it up to P versus NP, which was the dream a while back, I'm dubious of that.
In fact, if anything, I think the fact that we only can prove lower bounds in such weak models, I think this argues to the difficulty of proving P non-dimensional NP.
Yeah.
It doesn't really give you much evidence. I mean, how long has that been since we've had a major circuit lower bounds, Bill?
Let's see, Parity? Is the last one?
No, I would go with Roswell-Szymanski.
Okay.
1987, so almost 20 years ago.
You mean Mod 2, not with Andor, and not for Mod 3 games?
Right, they're not counting for you know, weak monotone models, but in general. The reality is, no, we've gotten stuck. God makes this as a point for that P should not equal to NP. In fact, I think it's actually almost more of an argument for P equals NP because we've made such little progress. but I think it's not an argument for P equals NP, just an argument for the hardness of proving P not equal NP, which is also something I believe in, that it's going to be a hard problem to solve.
Okay, so we believe it's hard, but we don't believe this is evidence that P is on NP.
Right.
And once again, me and Lance and I do both believe that P is not NP. Right. Reason 8. I've got to ask Scott, is my favorite reason on your list, I don't know if you're serious. Here's how it goes. If P equals NP, then, by that very fact, one would expect that finding proofs of theorems, for example, P equals NP, would be easy to find. If P is not NP, then because P is not NP, finding proofs of theorems like P not NP would be hard to find. So, since we haven't found a proof of P not NP, it is more likely that P is not NP.
Okay, so I like to call this the time traveler argument, right? You know, we know time travel is impossible because if time travel is possible, someone would have traveled back in time to visit us.
I find that more plausible, actually.
Actually, but here's the problem with Scott's arguments, okay? I mean, he applies it to the P versus NP question, but it can be applied to, say, Fermat's Last Theorem or the Poincaré conjecture, and guess what? We found those proofs.
No. To be fair to Scott, P equals NP itself is about hardest finding proofs.
No, what I'm saying is you can apply the... I mean, suppose P were not equal NP.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose P equals NP. It says that on the very grounds you should expect to prove not just P equals NP, but all these other two theorems. And, you know, and actually, you know, it does seem that over time we actually prove everything.
That's true.
It could be that P equals NP, just maybe with a large exponent.
So it reminds me, I've heard that the best way to conjecture when an open problem is going to be solved is guess how long it's already been open. And you'll mostly be right, and then be very, very wrong. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So, although I think it's amusing. I like A as being amusing. The trouble is, I don't know if Scott is serious here. Then again, I never know when Scott's serious.
As far as I know, all 10 of these things are not serious by Scott.
Well, actually, by the way, I want to point out a positive thing about Scott here. We're not here to trash him. I mean, I think it's a great list. I am going to have my class look at this list themselves and see what they think of it later. How about you?
I don't think we're here to trash Scott.
We are. Okay.
No, I take it back. Scott, we all love you.
Okay. 9 is...
No, I want to note, Scott Aronson was not consulted in the making of this podcast.
Okay, 9 is odd. As are you. Go ahead.
The philosophical argument.
Ooh.
If P equals NP, then the world will be a profoundly different place than we usually assume it to be. There will be no special value in creative leaps. No fundamental gap between solving a problem and recognized solution once it's found.
Really?
Everyone who could appreciate a symphony would be Mozart. Everyone who could follow step-by-step argument would be Gauss. But again, here, you could see this in technology, too. I mean, what do you have thought 30 years ago that everyone with a calculator would be able to solve big multiplication problems quickly?
Now we can.
I mean, the fact that the world often becomes a different place because of technological advances actually happens all the time. Think of how the internet, or even the telephone, or the railroad, you know, how these things have changed society over the years.
Philosophy. Yeah, the world does change. So just because you're saying P equals NP has consequences that are bizarre, that does not mean they're false.
That's true.
Yeah. So the world could change in these ways. So I find this not credible. Also, let me, as a side note, is that really even true? If P equals NP would, if P equals NP, the standard thing, if P equals NP with a large exponent, maybe we could know Mozart.
The point is could you formalize what it means to be a good symphony?
Ah.
And, you know, I mean, I think this whole Mozart argument, I've heard this, I guess, heard first from Steve Rich, formally requires you to write a computer program that can recognize a good symphony when it sees one. And I think we're nowhere near doing that. And then applying, or whatever, fewer symphony algorithm to it. So you make it sound that simple, but in fact, and also, even for mathematical proofs, take even the simplest of mathematical statements to write a formal proof of it. It's incredibly long. No one ever actually does it except for the very simple proofs.
Or also, theorem proofers try to do it or try to get a handle on it.
But it's not the case. I mean, there's some great things that would happen if P versus NP, particularly in learning, I think.
Yes.
It would be a great thing for society, personally, myself.
Okay, so 9 is more a reason to root for P equals NP as opposed to actually think it's not true.
Right.
Okay. 10. The utilitarian argument. Suppose you believe P is not NP. There are two possibilities, both of which are deeply gratifying. Either you're right, or else there's a way to solve NP complete problems in polytime. Why is that good?
So you believe P not equal NP is an insurance policy.
Oh, okay.
So that way, that if it turns out that P doesn't equal NP, and therefore you don't get this huge greatness, well, guess what? You guessed correctly.
Okay, so
That's like rooting against the team you want to win a football game.
Okay, or betting on the different team. Yeah. If you want team A and bet team B, you win either way. It's great.
Yeah, I once had a friend who bet against him. You know, bets with friends that he wouldn't get tenure, figuring that if he got tenure, he would be happy to pay off the bet. If he didn't get tenure, at least he'd get some money out of it.
That would be a lot of money, actually. Okay. Yeah, again, I think 10. I'm not sure Scott said about 10. So it's like the... What was it? The bad news is it was a terrorist attack, for example. The good news is I called it! Okay, anyway, so at 10, I don't see it as a serious reason. So I'll put that as a no, and you?
No.
No.
No, and I don't even think Scott considers that a serious reason.
I can put three no's here, but he's not here. Okay, so I find the empirical argument to be the most reasonable one. I think so do you.
Yes.
That is, so to restate it for our audience, that we have been working on these problems for a very long time and have made no progress on them, things like Hamiltonian cycle, satisfiability. Hamiltonian cycle is especially intriguing because you could even say it began in 1736. People in math wanted a way to characterize Hamiltonian graphs the same way they can characterize Eulerian graphs. Back then, they didn't really have they didn't have the terminology we have now for polytime algorithms, but I think it was along those lines, though.
Okay. And outside of these 10, shall we talk about our own reasons why we think P not equal NP?
Okay, go ahead. What's yours? Well,
mine is the God is evil argument.
Oh, gosh.
which is the following. It's basically P equals NP. It's related to Scott's philosophical argument, but a little bit different. Basically, it's saying, well, P equals NP would be such a wonderful, incredible, beautiful world where everything was so nice, you could learn things so quickly, etc., etc., etc. There's no way it could be true.
Okay, and my reason to think that P is not NP is that if P equals NP, then a lot of my friends be out of work. So therefore, I cling to P, not NP.
So you do have the big T.
I have tenure, but some of my friends do not. I may get paid less. I may get less grants, for example. I mean, it's a problem.
But don't worry. Even if P equals NP, there's always communication complexity.
Indeed. I'm glad to work on it. Okay.
And we know. And?
Yeah, that's right. That's actually another question, perhaps another day. If P equals NP, how much of theory would change? A lot, obviously. Yeah, the question is, though, would it change what we do?
Would it change what we do?
Or how would it change what we do?
I'm going to have to say, it does make about 80% of my papers trivial.
Let's see, actually, I've worked mostly in recursion theory and complexity, so I think I'm okay there.
I have a lot of these, bounded query papers on NP stuff, which would be trivial.
I do bounded queries and recursion theory for love, and bounded queries to SAT for money.
Okay, Bill. Thanks for being my guest again.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, and for all of you out there, remember, in a complex world, best to keep it simple.